It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go into the archives in a little bit to play an old interview, but I do want to start today's show, with just a little, a few things to mark your calendars with. Sometimes film sociology becomes stage sociology, as you know, especially when it's a play involving myself. For instance, August 4th through the 6th and the 11th and 13th at Richmond Civic Theater in Richmond, Indiana, you can see myself as well as my daughter Emma in a production of Fiddler on the Roof. Emma's in the chorus, I'm playing the rabbi. You can go to gorct.org for more information. And there have been a number of groups that have been trying to get on the show, and due to scheduling conflicts, it just doesn't happen. But that being said, if you have no interest in seeing Dunkirk or Maudie, you should mark your calendars because the play Rhinoceros is happening at Theater on the Square July 28th through August 13th. Midsummer Night's Dream is happening up at Federal Hill in Noblesville. That's running July 27th through August 5th. The Chaos production of Much Ado About Nothing is happening. The final performances are this weekend at 1775 North Sherman Drive. Of course, Shakespeare on the Canal with As You Like It, July 27th through the 29th. And the IU production of Love's Labor's Lost and Persuasion is running. I think their final weekend is this weekend as well. And further on down the road, Indie Jazz Fest is happening September 14th through the 23rd. So anyway, mark your calendars on all of those programs. And, of course, Indie Fringe is coming up in August, where there will be shows like St. Harley Adventure Girl, as well as and many, many others. So anyway, I hope there's something for you to see in Indiana, whether it's film or theater. So there you go. That being said, ladies and gentlemen, do not miss Dunkirk. The bigger the screen, the better the better experience it's going to be. I got to see it yesterday, and got to see it in IMAX. There are times I can still handle IMAX. There are still some folks redefine IMAX as loud. It is that. It's a story of Belgium, English, and French soldiers surrounded by the German army as they're trying to. I think David Edelstein called it the most heroic retreat in cinema history. And it's written and directed by Christopher Nolan. And there are some familiar faces in it, like Kenneth Branagh, Mark Rylance, Tom Hardy. This is the second Christopher Nolan film where Tom Hardy's face is covered mostly. And Cillian Murphy, as well as younger faces like James Darcy, Jack Loudon, and Fiona Whitehead. And there's a few interchanging stories involving two soldiers who may or may not have their own agenda going on. You have the stern officer with Ken Branagh, and then you have Mark Rylance and his son and companion who go off on their own ship to pick up soldiers that are floating in the water. There is a little bit of nonlinear storytelling in this film, and because it's Christopher Nolan, it's been known to happen. Edelstein refers to it as Nolan time. And that being said, this is one of the most tense films I've seen in a long time. And I kind of got, I forgot that there was nonlinear storytelling, and it didn't really bother me. Also, the fact, folks, is it's under 2 hours. It's only about an hour and 46 minutes. So it's shorter than your average Nolan picture. So you got that going for it. But it is extremely tense as far as the feeling of dread, of isolation, of obviously of cover, of dread, whether you're stuck in a ship or a ship is sinking, if you're stuck in an airplane. It's all these, and Tom Hardy is in a fighter plane, and there's some things that we're used to when seeing in war films, like the fighter plane that's trying to figure out how much fuel it actually has left while it's out in combat. Very tense film. And a few moments in the film that there are some light moments, but they are brief. I believe Mr. Edelstein in his Fresh Air review kind of said it was a little bit on the corny side. I don't think it is. We get a little bit of levity, but even in war, levity doesn't last long. And you are just jerked back into a different part of action after a couple of really nice moments. One that really put a lump in my throat. And but that being said, it is a really strong war picture, and the helplessness and the isolation is all captured. And again, seeing it on IMAX, it is big and it is loud, but it's definitely worth checking out. This is my favorite film of the summer, and it's early, but I wouldn't be surprised if this made it my top 10 of the year. But, you know, we got to wait for the second half of the calendar to happen. Now, if war films are not your cup of tea, there is a film that's opening up at the Art House Theater on the north side. It's a little Canadian-Irish drama called Maudie, and it stars Ethan Hawke and Sally Hawkins. Sally is an arthritic woman who gets a job as a housekeeper for Ethan Hawke, who speaks low and slow and not a whole lot. And as time goes on, a relationship, and I don't use finger quotes on that, but it is not your conventional cinematic relationship, starts to flourish. And as time goes on, we find out that the Sally Hawkins character, Maudie, it makes herself quite a painter. This is based on a true story. And as time goes on, she becomes known for her paintings. Somebody in New York buys one of them. And further on down the road, she gets requests for her paintings from Vice President Nixon, and the TV cameras start to show up. But it's not a celebrity story, and the performances by Hawke and Hawkins are really strong. It feels to the unconventional eye that they don't really change, but they do in a very subtle way. It's a very subtle relationship between these two characters and these two performances. It's shot in Nova Scotia, and the film kind of reflects the house and the location. It is gray and cold at times, but if you take a strong look, especially inside the house, inside the heart, there are lovely flourishes of color by Sally Hawkins as a painter and by Maud, the character. They work really, really well together. And this is a film that normally feels like it would be in the second half of the year, and it would be around awards season time. So I hope you don't forget this. If you're not up for seeing Dunkirk or any of the summer blockbuster movies, here is a smart, sweet, cold at times alternative. And hopefully it'll be remembered at the end of the year as well. All right, shifting gears a little bit, over at the Tibbs Drive-In, that's interesting pairings here. I don't know if Dunkirk is ready for drive-ins, and that's really okay. IMAX is fine. On screen one at the Tibbs, War for the Planet of the Apes and The House. Screen two, Despicable Me 3 and Cars 3. Screen 3, Spider-Man Homecoming and Baby Driver. And screen 4, Wish Upon and Wonder Woman. Over at the Skyline in Shelbyville, you have War for the Planet of the Apes, as well as 47 Meters Down. Update for the summer movie series at the IMA. They are all sold out except for Serenity, Friday, August 18th at 7 p.m. Over at the Keystone Arts, depending on when you're listening to this show, Fantastic Planet, Saturday night at midnight, and then next weekend, the 28th and 29th, their final weekend of the Midnight Movie Series for the summer, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So anyway, those are definitely worth checking out. And over at the, I'm checking it now, over at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Indiana, just south of here, going down. Singing in the Rain is happening at 7:30 on Saturday the 22nd. Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner movie Tuesday the 25th at 10 a.m. And in mark your calendars, Best in Show August 4th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. And then August 5th, this is a live thing. Pappy Wilson's Down Home Franklin Jamboree, a radio-style live stage production happening Saturday, August 5th. So there are those. And as I mentioned earlier, you can check out Fiddler on the Roof at Richmond Civic, August 4th through the 6th and 11th through the 13th. You can go to gorct.org for all the ticket information there. Emma's in the chorus, and I'm playing the rabbi. All right, shifting gears. We have to get to Dead People We Like because we don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Red West. Red West is best known as one of the members of Elvis Presley's Memphis Mafia and one of his lackeys, one of his hangers-on, one of his security crew, and wound up appearing in a number of Elvis films uncredited, everything from Flaming Star to Kid Galahad to It Happened at the World's Fair to Harum Scarum. But as time went on, he wound up getting some film and TV roles in non-Elvis films. So he appeared in the TV series of Mission Impossible, in Wild Wild West, in Mannix, appeared as Sheriff Tanner in Walking Tall and Walking Tall Part 2, appeared in the films Framed with Joe Don Baker, again, a lot of TV after Elvis died, and then, I guess I'm going through, played Red Webster in Roadhouse, appeared in The Legend of Grizzly Adams, films like Raw Nerve, Prey of the Chameleon, played the judge in The Gun and Betty Lou's Handbag, for you Penelope Ann Miller fans out there, The Rainmaker, I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, Cookie's Fortune, Above Suspicion, Glory Road, 40 Shades of Blue, not 50 Shades of Grey. And then I know a very strong two-person film called Goodbye Solo. That was back in 2008. Last week, of course, on the same day, actually a few hours from each other, George Romero and Martin Landau passed away. George Romero was 77, and Friday on Fresh Air, they replayed an interview she did with Romero. Romero only had 20 credits as a director, but pretty memorable for the most part. His first full-length feature, of course, 1968's Night of the Living Dead, which changed horror films and is the godfather of zombie films as we know it today. Lou Harry's written books about zombies. There's zombies every other thing is a zombie project out there, whether it's The Walking Dead or video games. All of them owe it to George A. Romero. And while he did that, and then, of course, he made a very strong sequel, some say was even better than Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, with the symbolism of zombies in a mall. Get it? Never, and then everything else had to live up to those, and they never quite made it. But there's still some strong work in his canon. Films like Season of the Witch, The Crazies, Martin, Knight Riders, which is a rare non-horror film with Ed Harris and Tom Savini, the Knights on Motorcycles. Of course, Creepshow from 1982, Day of the Dead, Monkey Shines from 1988, An Experiment in Terror, The Dark Half from 1993, did a couple one of the segments in Two Evil Eyes, the film Bruiser, and then kind of went to the well a little bit with Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, and Survival of the Dead. But he's a part of cinema history, and his legacy is just going to keep going and going. Now, Martin Landau, going back, and yeah, I'll be rattling through his IMDb because that's what I do. Classically trained stage actor in New York, did a lot of TV, and one of his first films, well, 1959 was quite the year. He appeared as Lieutenant Marshall in Porkchop Hill and then played Leonard in Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. And this was one of those guys that didn't matter if it was TV or movies, so long as he was working, and he got pigeonholed into a lot of TV. But he did appear in films like Cleopatra, Decision at Midnight, The Hallelujah Trail, The Greatest Story Ever Told. That Hallelujah Trail, he played Chief Walks Stooped Over. This is when folks like Martin Landau got to play Native American roles. Nevada Smith, of course, was in the original Mission Impossible. They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, Black Gun, which I'll get to in a little bit. He was one of my favorite performances in Columbo. He played twins, and you had to figure out which one was the killer. The Last Word, Meteor, Without Warning, The Return. Of course, he did Space 1999 from 75 to 77. Alone in the Dark from 1982. And kind of got pigeonholed, known as a TV actor. But the thing about him was, no matter how big or how small the project, he brought it. And then had a kind of a late resurgence in 1988. Received his first Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor for Tucker, The Man and His Dream, the Francis Coppola film. Had another nomination the following year in Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors. And then a few years later, I remember seeing him in Mistress, which is an underrated comedy with Barry Primus wrote and directed, if I remember right. And then, of course, in 1994, for many people, upsetting Samuel L. Jackson for winning Best Supporting Actor in my favorite Tim Burton film, Ed Wood. I thought he was great as Bela Lugosi. And for me, it did not feel like a token career achievement award. I thought he was that good and that funny as Bela. Funny, and then, of course, to bring the heartache of Lugosi's addiction and going through rehab. I think it's just a marvelous piece of work. And never forget, he stopped the symphony so he could finish his Oscar speech. He was one of those. Appeared in City Hall. The first thing my daughter saw him in, he played Geppetto in The Adventures of Pinocchio from 1996. He appeared in BAPS, and he appeared in The X-Files, played one of the card-playing judges in Rounders, EdTV, Ready to Rumble, Shiner, The Majestic, The Commission, Hollywood Homicide, just kept working up until he was 89 when he passed away, and had at least one film finished in 2017. So just really wonderful work from Martin Landau. And I hope to get Joe Shearer on the show. He got to interview Landau, and I would love to pick his brain a little bit more about that. Watched Ed Wood earlier this week and just revisiting that. Just a fun Valentine to Ed Wood, where Tim Burton did not laugh at him. He laughed with him. But to capture Wood's passion for filmmaking and the trust that Ed Wood had in Bela Lugosi, even though Lugosi was drug addicted and past his prime, still brought it. And I think that's all we can ask of folks. And really strong performance in Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, where he is an ophthalmologist who winds up getting his mistress whacked. And there are elements of Crime and Punishment. And this is a storyline that Woody would later revisit in films like Match Point and Cassandra's Dream. But a really good ensemble piece in that film. Jerry Orbach is in it, as well as Angelica Houston, Woody Allen, Mia Farrell, Alan Alda. But Landau is the best part about that. And then I own it on DVD because I enjoy the films of Jim Brown, and he played a mobster middleman in Black Gun, and he's only in a handful of scenes at the very beginning and then at the very end. He also has a front as a used car salesman, so you get to see a lot of cool single shots, long takes of him doing the live used car shtick, which is pretty entertaining. Jim Brown plays a club owner. They call him Gun, with two N's, and whose brother is caught up with a black coalition group that's clashing with organized crime. And Jim Brown is caught in the middle. Not a good thing to happen because he's Jim Brown. But also Vida Blue, the Oakland A's pitcher, has a cameo, as does Deacon Jones. But this was, again, not a big role for Martin Landau, but an example of delivering, even if it was something as silly as a Jim Brown B-movie. So salute to Martin Landau. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back after the break, we're going to dip into the archives. So stick around. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Socey. Before we go into the archives, there's a couple of titles I do want to talk about that are on video. The big title this week on your home video on DVD and Blu-ray is Kong Skull Island, which is the, I say it's the spastic younger brother of the last film version of Godzilla. It's another film where we have actors we really like getting paid, hopefully a lot of money, to do not as much as they have in previous films. You have a cast that includes Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, John Goodman, John C. Reilly, and it's the eclectic group of folks going to an undiscovered island and finding Kong. And yes, there are such things as Tom Hiddleston, action hero, John C. Reilly doing his best impression of Colonel Kurtz in Hearts of Darkness or Apocalypse Now. Brie Larson, jumping into a body of water in one scene and her hair being bone dry the next. And Samuel L. Jackson having a face off with Kong. Fun stuff. It's big and loud and obnoxious, but fun nonetheless. If you don't get enough Brie Larson with Kong Skull Island, she's also in the ensemble crime film Free Fire. And apparently 90s Tarantino knockoffs are in vogue. This is Brie Larson, Cillian Murphy, because you haven't had enough of him in Dunkirk, Armie Hammer, and Charlton Copley as a guns deal gone bad in the 70s in Boston. Everybody is in period clothing and fast-snapping dialogue as well as a lot of bullets. I forgot to mention earlier, cough break, that there's some nice scenes with Cillian Murphy in Dunkirk. He plays a soldier that is rescued out of the water by Mark Rylance. And Murphy's character is, as Rylance says, is not the same. He's, just coming off shock of crashing in the water and really does not want to go back to Dunkirk. Wanted to mention that. I know Murphy's one of the regular Christopher Nolan players, but a really good performance from him. But anyway, Free Fire is, if you remember films like 2 Days in the Valley or Before the Things to Do in Denver Before You're Dead or Suicide Kings, it's that kind of film. I'm sure everybody's having fun. I just didn't have as much fun as they did. Going into the archives, these are the films that folks like Warner Brothers or Paramount, stuff that you have to buy online, or as Kobe used to say, he would burn it for you for $5. We go to the 1949 Anthony Mann Western called Devil's Doorway, starring Robert Taylor. Taylor plays a Native American and Civil War hero who returns. He has a Congressional Medal of Honor. And adjusting to civilian life, especially as a Native American in the Old West, not equal at war, but not at home. His father's dying. The white doctor won't make a house call. He has a friend who is sheriff, but we find out that Wyoming is now part of the U.S. And even something as simple as you're not being able to get a drink at a saloon. Mann, of course, is the film gentleman who gave us films like Winchester 73, The Tin Star, The Glenn Miller Story, and El Cid. And tackling this subject of racism in the West in 1949 is a little ahead of its time. He winds up going to get a lawyer, a female lawyer. It's her first client, about land ownership. So it does address some issues that you don't expect. There's some gray in a black and white world of the 1940s Westerns. So anyway, that is worth checking out if you can. Before I get to my interview with classic interview with Elmore Leonard, I have to mention the Soucy family went on vacation recently. We did an Airbnb in Stratford, Ontario. And as a nice little thing, the people who own the apartment left some Blu-rays if we opted to go that way. We tried watching Julia and Julia, but the disc wasn't working. But they did have a 3-disc set of Blu-ray collection of That's Entertainment, if you remember those. I remember the first two, never saw the third. There was an offshoot called That's Dancing from 1985, which I got to see in the theater. And but watching the first two, That's Entertainment was put out by MGM in 1974. They made a sequel in 1976. It is the cinema greatest hits package. Basically, the first film was musical, memorable music, musical moments, everything from Busby Berkeley to Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, and then Sinatra. And I say there were people like Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Liza Minnelli. Elizabeth Taylor all have these and little hosting points in the first film. A little get off my lawn, especially from the likes of Crosby and Sinatra. And in the poster for That's Entertainment, it says something along the lines of, boy, do we need this now, or we need this more than ever. Kind of a smack to the counterculture. And by the way, Warner Brothers, or I say MGM and United Artists, they were putting out films that were director-driven in the 70s as well. Let's never forget that. And then they made a sequel with more musical highlights as well as movie highlights, acting highlights, and it was hosted by Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire. It's just a... I don't know. If anything else, it made Emma my daughter wanted to go and check out the films that these clips came from. But this was an interesting G-rated piece of counterculture that MGM put out in the mid-1970s. Okay, we have just enough time to dip into the archives. Well, it's an epic archive interview, but it's one I enjoy because this is my... Speaking of Geppetto, Elmore Leonard was the person that made this show real because he said it was a real show. So, ladies and gentlemen, here is my 30-minute chat with the late, great writer Elmore Leonard. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is a writer that makes me proud to be a writer who grew up in Michigan. Elmore Leonard, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Just
writing a book.
What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm writing a book based, well, it's a Raylan book, Raylan Who's in Justified.
Mm-hmm.
I've already written two books that he stars in, so I thought, what the heck, well, Justified is running, I might as well write another one. Maybe they can use some of it, which they are going to do a little bit here and there, but it's a novel. It's not really based on anything that they're doing on the show.
Have you enjoyed the show so far?
I think it's great. It's so amazing that it seems so lifelike. It's so realistic the way they talk. I can't believe it.
Well, the source doesn't fall too far from the tree, sir.
Well, they did wear those little bracelets that said, "Well, what would Elmore do?" You know, that was nice. That was
right.
That was kind of.
Now, when you're creating characters, do you know ones whether you're writing or when you finish that you know you're going to use again in future books?
No, never. But at least I don't think about it.
Okay.
But I'll see. For example, I'll see a photograph in the newspaper, a couple of marshals standing in front of the federal courthouse in Miami. And the woman has a shotgun on her, well, the stock is on her hip, and she's holding it up at an angle, and she's good looking. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I got to use her. No question about it. Or when I met the guy named Raylan, I was in, where was I, in Texas? Amarillo, I think. And I was giving a talk at a luncheon, a book company that, well, they're not a publishing company, but they provide the books to bookstores and so on. And I was introduced to this fellow who was going to introduce me, and he said, "Hi, I'm Raylan." I said, "Raylan? God, I got to use your name if it's okay." I said, "That's perfect." And I've used it twice.
Now, have people come out of the woodworks claiming that they were the inspiration for some of your characters in the past?
I haven't heard it, no.
Okay. The current crisis going on in Detroit, whether it's the government or that's money or the city declining, has that been inspiration for future work?
No. No, but I use Detroit because I know it. I've been here since the fourth grade. There's a lot of activity, but it's a big, robust, rowdy town, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed it here. It's fallen on bad times. There's no question about that. The people who know how to make cars, they're still around, but they've moved out to suburbs. There are about 900,000 people living in Detroit, but all the suburbs are bustling, and that's where they live. But I just heard today that it's going to be tougher for auto workers who don't have necessary skills, that it's going to be different now in the area of manufacturing. They're going to have to learn a new way of doing things. So I don't know. I suppose they will. You know, what happened to all the blacksmiths? I'm sure they got a job.
Eventually. If you don't mind me asking, what part of town do you live on?
I live out in Bloomfield Village, which is, 16 miles north of Detroit.
Yes.
Well, the line, the Detroit line is at 8 Mile, and we live just north of 15, near 16 Mile Road.
Well, going back a little bit, what were some of the movies you watched growing up, and did they have any inspiration to you when it became when you wanted to be a writer?
Yes, one in particular, All Quiet on the Western Front, and it was released in 1931. I saw it; it kept coming back. I mean, this was before television, but I saw it at least twice in movie theaters. And I was inspired in the fifth grade to write a play. That was 1935. And I wrote a World War I play where the Germans were on one side of the classroom and the Americans were on the other, and one of the Americans crawls under the desk, which is no man's land, and gets caught and gets shot, and somebody has to go out and save him. And I think it was the coward of the outfit who goes out and saves them. I'm not sure now. I wish I had that script. It'd be valuable. But we put it on one performance in the classroom. And that was it. So our teacher, the sister who was our homeroom, well, we were always in the same room,
mm-hmm.
and the mother superior of the school came and watched it, and that was it. That was the first thing I'd ever written, I didn't write really anything else until college. And then right after I got out of college, I started writing Westerns because I saw a wonderful market for them, with especially pulp magazines and also Saturday Evening Post and Collier's. The bigger pay magazines were always running Westerns. I finally did sell one to the Post. But I sold, while I was working at an ad agency, I sold at least 30 short stories, and most of those were to the pulp magazines, Dime Western and 10 Story Western, like that. They paid 2 cents a word. 310 to Yuma, I got $90 for, but it was made into two movies.
Correct.
I still didn't make any money off them.
You mentioned All's Quiet on the Western Front. Did the film inspire you to read the book, and were there other examples of that you saw a movie and you wanted to read it?
Well, it was, I think in 35, it was in the Detroit Times, the whole book,
mm-hmm.
probably over several issues, you know.
Right.
And I remember lying on the floor reading it in our living room and thinking, God, this would be a good play. And I don't know why I thought of play. You know, it's probably the only time in my life I ever thought in that way about a play, because I certainly haven't thought about it lately.
You never wrote any more plays after that?
No. Mm-mm.
Did you ever see the film Rushmore?
That sounds familiar.
Wes Anderson?
Oh, yeah.
There's,
I'm not sure if I did, though.
Well, there's a scene where it's set in a private high school, and the lead character does stage versions of movies, and one of the movies he stages is Out of Sight.
Really?
Yeah, he does the trunk. You see the trunk scene.
Oh.
You can add that to your rental list.
You know, people, directors who were thinking about doing that one, they said, God, that's a great scene. In the dark, and
mm-hmm.
one of them, the one who finally did it, Summer
Soderbergh,
huh?
Steven Soderbergh.
Anyway, he said, "I'm going to do it. I want to do that scene, screen black." I said, "Why? I think you'll lose a lot of your audience." Well, he didn't do it that way, but there were so many different ways of doing it that everybody liked that scene.
Well, going back to movies you watched younger, was there ever a film that you read the book and then you saw the movie and you thought, what in God's name did they do? Because it seemed like that happened to quite a bit of your work in the future.
Yeah, it has. No, I don't recall looking at them that way.
Okay.
No, but I wanted to write movies immediately because I wanted to make money. That was my whole idea. Getting into writing and developing a particular style that I liked, and selling to the movies had to be, and I did. I saw 1953. I saw my first one, which was 310 to Yuma.
What happened? They called you and they offered, and that was it.
My agent. I had an agent, and he called me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And what did you think of the film?
It was, it wasn't 310 to Yuma. I wrote it in 53, but it didn't come out until 57.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed there were two titles, Moment of Vengeance and The Tall T, I believe, before 310.
Moment of Vengeance was a TV thing. That was in the Saturday Evening Post, a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was on the Slitz Playhouse. And it was okay, you know, wasn't anything special. But the first one was the first movie was The Big Bounce. And I remember saying to my agent, I said, this is the second worst movie I ever saw. And then they remade it like 5 years ago.
Yeah, I remember.
And I said, well, now I know what the worst movie is. They didn't seem to know what they were doing. They shot it in Hawaii. It took place up in the Thumb area of Michigan.
I know within 310 to Yuma, and I know you also, Hombre was later made into a movie.
Yeah, about 67, I think it was.
Did that one fare any better for you?
Oh, yeah. I liked Hombre a lot. Didn't get a very good review in Time Magazine or Newsweek, but I loved it. I thought it really worked. And I remember in the theater, everybody in the end, Newman is shot at the end of the picture, and then the end credits come on, and everybody just sat there because they didn't believe anybody would shoot Paul Newman or he would die in a movie, you know.
And for that time, Newman was also one of the the time-honored tradition of the white man playing Indians.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, I read that I think your first screenplay credit was The Moonshine War.
Yeah.
How was that experience, and how did it come about?
It was about a guy who made whiskey in Kentucky in 32. It was against the law, of course, and he kept it hidden. And the revenuers are always looking for his whiskey. And finally, I don't really remember what the story was, but It was not a good movie. I saw it a couple of times, and that was it.
It seems like when you wrote a screenplay, did you approach it any different than, say, writing one of your novels?
No, I approached it, though, as though I were adapting the novel. I mean, I didn't look for any other ways to do it. Mm-hmm. And they seemed to me always to make sense, that they would make good pictures. I remember I did one, God, I forgot what it was, for TriStar. The one that I did for TriStar, I remember I went to a meeting there, and these three guys were sitting at a table and looking at me, and the guy in the middle said, "Well, all you did was turn the book into a screenplay. I said, "Yes, that's what I did." And he said, "Well, hell, anybody can do that. You know, you just use the film way of writing instead of prose. This is when I saw that. I hadn't thought of anything new and different to put in, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was necessary. And that's when I began to realize I should not be writing movies. So finally, in 93, I quit.
Now, I can't remember. Was Mr. Majestic a novel first and then a film, or was it the other way around?
It was a screenplay first.
Okay.
And then I remember my agent saying, "You're going to have to add a lot of descriptions to make this book length." I said, "No, you add a lot of dialogue. You add it going down, up and down, not across, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So that worked fine. I'm still getting residuals for Mr. Majestic. What was that? That came out in 73.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, you know, 40-something years later.
If you don't mind me asking, are you getting a number of checks for different films? I know, or if not all of them?
Well, I'm always surprised when one that's not very good, the Moonshine War, I'll get, you know, $100 or $123 for that. Or one I did for Eastwood, Joe Kidd.
Mm-hmm.
I'll finally get a residual for that one, which was not a good movie at all. I listened to the director.
What did he tell you?
Well, he said, this guy who is your bad guy, he said, I think he should be a good guy. He should be, well, once you get rid of your bad guy and he's going to turn out to be good, then who's the bad guy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I have to name somebody who worked for him, and it was just too contrived.
It seems like for a long, long time that directors didn't know what to do with the screenplay, or, as you said, rewrote it themselves.
Yeah. Well, directors do a lot of rewriting.
Even though you get a credit, I think of, and say what you will about the film Stick, it did inspire me to start reading your novels. I will give it that. Yeah. I was a Burt Reynolds fan, and I saw the film, and then I read the really scathing reviews, and I remember, what was it, Newsweek, I said that Burt Reynolds took an Elmore Leonard novel and turned it into a Mickey Spillane film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had some friends that said, "Look, if you should really read his novel and check out what happened." And
yeah.
And I remember reading it going, "How could you drop the ball on this?"
Well, the first thing he said was, "Burt," he mm-hmm. said, "I thought I'd leave my hairpiece off for this one." I said, "Yeah?" But what he meant was he would wear a much smaller hairpiece that looked like he had just gotten a haircut or something.
Uh-huh.
But it was his kind of a picture. It was he always made the scenes bigger than they were in the book. If there's a party at a lawn party at someone's house where there were maybe six people there, well, he brought in 100 people, and then he has boats passing in front of them with all lit up, you know. He's that old school of let's add more to it if it's a movie, you know. That was a terrible movie.
I remember reading in an article once that you had the poster in your office and you changed the tagline from the film.
Oh yeah.
The only thing you couldn't stick to was the script.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you still have that?
No, it was in the bathroom.
So you have, dare I say, do you have posters that are
no,
in certain rooms?
No, I don't have any in the house.
Okay, I was saying.
Say,
it sounds like the bathroom reflects the product.
Yeah, my barber has about a half dozen of them on his walls.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll have to find that.
Good, too.
And it seemed, so finally in the 90s, it seemed like you had a good streak with Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight. What do you think happened? Or were people finally starting to appreciate your work?
Well, it took me a long time to be discovered. I was writing for, I started in the 50s, 60s, 70s. It wasn't until 85 that I hit the bestseller list, the Times list.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a New York Times review where I was discovered. The guy says, "Hey, this guy, I think he's writing better than anybody I can think of." You know.
But I know Get Shorty, I think, was the first of them. Do you remember being approached by Barry Sonnenfeld to have that film made?
I heard that Travolta was going to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my agent, I said, "God, don't sell it. Don't sell it." Because he was in Look Who's Talking. I thought, I don't think he's the guy for this one. But it turned out he was. He was good in it.
Well, and he had just come off of Pulp Fiction, and I remember seeing interviews with Quentin Tarantino, who was praising your work to everybody who would listen.
Yeah.
In fact, I think in Rolling Stone magazine, the review started with the fact that that Elmore Leonard was writing Pulp Fiction long before Quentin Tarantino ever uttered his first FU.
Yeah, he was a big fan from the beginning.
When did he start getting in touch with you about adapting Rum Punch?
I only talked to him two or three times on the phone, and he told me that he was going to cast Robert, what was his name?
Forster.
Yeah, Forster. I said, "Robert Forster? He hasn't been in a picture in 20 years. He was in that something in Chicago during the convention."
Oh, medium cool.
Medium cool.
Yeah.
Right. And he says, "Oh, no, he's good." Well, and he didn't tell me, though, that he was also casting Pam Grier. But I was, whatever he wanted to do was okay with me because I always liked his stuff.
So, yeah, you were a fan of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
It's funny. I interviewed Fred Williamson many years ago, and he worked with Forrester in many films. And his joke complaint was he had Forrester play that character for years, and then he works with some other director and gets a nomination for it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think Tarantino's adaptation was probably the closest of any picture that was made of mine.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I suppose, once he cast Pam Grier, then he's on his way. He knows who the girl is, and she's the main character.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the story. It was my story all the way.
Is that your favorite of the group, as if you have favorites?
I think that might be.
You get executive producer credits for some of these films, like Jackie Brown and Be Cool and Kill Shot and Justified. Is there any input, or did they just throw you that title?
I think I was just given that, yeah.
And I know I read on IMDb you have a production credit for apparently pre-production for Freaky Deaky. Do you know anything of that?
We haven't made it yet, have we?
No, it says pre-production.
Oh, pre-production. No, I don't know who's doing it.
I'm not at my computer right now, but I can check later and tell you. But that's just something, a piece of information I got off the internet.
Yeah.
Of all the films, what actor captured one of your characters the best?
I suppose Travolta.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I was surprised. Because when I told my agent that, "God, don't sell it to them," then I found out that he was in Pulp Fiction, was just released then. And I got to see it, and I thought, "Oh, my God, I'm glad he's in it," because he was perfect.
I say, have there been any films that you've watched recently? I don't know how often you go to the movies. I was just curious.
Well, I get them now.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Oscars, I get them all.
Did your votes win?
I thought the King's Speech would win, or the other one was that Sorkin wrote. I liked Sorkin's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great script, and I thought it's between those two.
Right.
But I was happy with the King's Speech because I liked it a lot.
Yeah, me too. I have a Michigan question because you set Killshot in Algonac, or part of it in Algonac. What brought that on?
Well, I don't know. I suppose just to do it, set it locally. Maybe I couldn't think of anywhere else.
I only ask because I have friends that live there, and I remember giving them a copy of the book as a gift, and they were quite tickled.
Oh.
Did you like that film version at all?
Oh, it was. I thought it was disappointing to me that they didn't end it the way the book ends,
mm-hmm.
where she shoots the guy, you know, and leaves it up to her husband, because he was kind of, he didn't have much of a part in it at all, and the fact that they were breaking up at one point, I thought it was just thrown in for plot, because in the book, they are in love with each other,
mm-hmm.
seriously, and they'll get into fights, into arguments, but it's over in a moment, you know.
And I remember when you spoke at Butler that was the ending for the second 310 to Yuma changed at the last minute.
I don't know. I think it because the writers. I did speak to the writers, and they were here doing another one. They said we didn't understand it, but the director wanted. Who was the guy? Who was the head hero?
Russell Crowe, Christian
Bale.
Yeah,
Russell Crowe. They wanted him to shoot his own guys and then get on the train. And they wrote it that way. And it didn't make any sense to me, nor it did to them. But they did it. I don't know what it meant.
If you don't mind me asking, how far are you into your new project?
I'm on page 272.
You just write until it ends?
I don't know how it ends yet, but I want to end it in about 30 or 40 pages.
Okay.
So I've got to think about how to end it.
What's the earliest you've ever written something and you knew how it was going to end?
It was Valdez Is Coming.
Really?
Yeah, because I knew that one. I thought of it, and I remember calling my agent in Hollywood and saying, I've got one for, and let's see, who was it going to be? I forgot the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you get a producer in the office and I'll sell it to him in 10 minutes. And he said, kiddo, write your book. But I did it in about 7 or 8 weeks, which is the fastest I've ever written a book.
Did you envision Burt Lancaster?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You did?
Yeah.
Because he had a couple of interesting Westerns at that time as well. There was also Lawman and Ulzana's Raid, and I thought they were pretty dark Westerns for that time.
Yeah, especially Ulzana's Raid, yeah.
Some people have written and some people have rumored that the Shorty and Get Shorty was inspired by Dustin Hoffman. Do you know if that's true?
Well, no, but he was up for playing the part at
I
one
see.
Time. And I said, the guy isn't that short. Because he, Get Shorty was just get this guy who was a popular star, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's all. And a lot of them are short. So, and that's why.
Well, I'm 5'5". They seem okay to me.
Oh, good. But Get, I don't know. Get Shorty just sort of came along as a title.
Okay.
And I didn't start with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because then when they got to Travolta, well, who's Get Shorty? Well, then at the very end, the woman production worker says, they're all short. You shoot up.
Back in the days when you also put them on a box in a kissing scene.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I just remember reading a long time ago, I think for a brief period, that Hoffman was linked to a film version of La Brava, which never happened.
Yeah, we spent a year with him. And with him and with directors, Scorsese was the first one, and then Ulu Grossbard, and then different, there were a couple of others. And we would, Walter Mirisch, who was going to produce it, he and I would go to New York and just sit and wait for the meeting to have a meeting. And then Dustin would come over and we'd talk about it. And then he said, no, then he would change the storyline. Well, where's my girlfriend? I don't have to have a girlfriend in this, you know, things like that.
Did he also order off the menu?
Always did that, yeah. That's where I got that.
I would say that captured a lot of business deals, it seems like.
And they also don't know their zip code or or their phone number if they're staying somewhere else.
Oh, wow. I say, if you're ever channel surfing and one of the films based on your books come on, do you watch it, or it depends on how good or how bad it is?
Well, no, I don't necessarily watch it. No.
Okay. Well, it seems like, especially with your body of work, there's always a lot of what could have been, especially with the body of work that you've put out over the years.
Well, we're still at it. We're still trying to sell them, because there are a bunch of them that we like, that we think would make very good movies, and... You know, nothing's happening but the studios just aren't as active as they used to be. That's the trouble. But we've got some that I think Swag. We've got a script for Swag. Then Sparks, which was a short film.
Mm-hmm.
Sparks is now being written for FX. They're going to try that one. Cuba Libre, I think we've got to sell that one. That's a big picture. The Hot Kid, Tishomingo Blues would be a good movie.
Well, so, there's always possibilities.
Oh yeah, always.
I say, are you familiar with a website called The Onion?
No.
It's a satirical newspaper, but their entertainment section, they do real writing. I mean, the news articles are jokes, but they actually have a serious. Entertainment section, and every week they have a column called Gateways to Geekery, and what they do is they pick out like a 101 course on how to start with a particular filmmaker or a particular writer or a particular musician, and last week you were the subject. And they recommended Out of Sight as a good first step into checking out your body of work. So good things are written about you on the internet.
I see the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it was on the internet because I don't have a computer.
You don't write on a computer?
No, I write in longhand.
Yellow pads and then typewriter?
It's an unlined yellow pads that I have made. They're 8.5 by 11 unlined yellow, and I've been using them ever since I was with an ad agency where we use these kinds of pads. So I order them. I order 63 pages to the pad, and then I get 100 pads.
How long would that last?
A year. No, not 100, 50. 50,
okay.
50 pads.
You can make a commercial with those and get an underwriting.
Yeah.
Your own brand of pads.
I go through a lot of pages, you know, because it takes me anywhere from three to sometimes five, just to get one clean page. Because I'm not sure what the scene is, you know, until
sure.
I get into it. But I've been doing it for 60 years, and I have a good time, so...
If it ain't broke.
Yeah, right.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
That was my classic chat with Elmore Leonard. Thanks, Dutch. So, ladies and gentlemen, go see a good movie. You deserve it. Go! Don't miss Dunkirk. Don't miss Maudie. And, Fiddler on the Roof opens in 2 weeks at Richmond Civic. Hope to see you there. GoRCT.org for more information. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. We'll be right back.
Bundesstring! Bundesstring!